Welcome to AM Best Audio.
Welcome to this AM Best TV special presentation, Emerging Insurance Asset Investment Risks and Opportunities. I'm John Weber. In today's rapidly evolving financial landscape, the insurance industry faces a multitude of challenges and opportunities when it comes to managing their investment portfolios. As insurers seek to generate returns in an environment of increasing market volatility, they must navigate through a range of emerging risks while also capitalizing on potential opportunities. Our panel of experts will explore the various factors shaping the investment strategies of insurance companies today as they navigate the risk in search of the opportunities. Now let's meet our panel. First, we welcome in Jason Hopper from our studios here. He's Associate Director of AM Best.
Thanks, John.
Next, we say hello to Mark Silverstein. Mark is the Chief Investment Officer at Sompo.
Hello.
And last but not least, we have Lena Punjabi, the Chief Investment Officer for F&G Annuities and Life. And Lena, we're going to kick things off with you today. What opportunities are you seeing in the market these days?
Sure, John. First, thank you for having me. Second, the perspective I'm going to share today represents my own views and not necessarily those of F&G. In terms of the opportunities we're seeing in the markets today, I will say they're not as abundant as they were in 2022 and 23. During that period, we saw a significant and rapid increase in rates, as well as a banking turmoil, which meant that investors were more concerned about risk and they were demanding higher spreads. However, given the continuing strength in the labor markets and the economy in general that we see now, risk has taken a back seat and spreads have come in meaningfully, especially for public assets. Where we are still seeing value, though, is in private asset classes, and in particular assets that are originated and were historically also retained by banks in the banking channel. These are things like consumer and asset-based finance. But because of deposit flight and impending regulation, banks are not retaining as much as they used to on their balance sheets, and in some cases, even offloading what they already have. And this presents an opportunity for insurance companies like ours. We have sticky and long-duration liabilities, and these assets are a really good fit for that liability profile. So we are actually partnering with these banks to buy these assets, and that's where we are seeing tremendous opportunity.
Jason, would commercial loans be part of that opportunity that Lena was discussing?
Yeah, I mean, life insurers specifically have been increasing their allocations to commercial mortgage loans over the last number of years, right? Throughout the entire low interest rate environment over the last decade, commercial mortgage loans offered higher yields than the typical public corporate bond, right? So that was one positive factor historically. They've performed well, very few problem loans in general, tighter, stricter underwriting typically than their banking counterparts, right? At the same time, problem loans have not really been an issue. However, over the last 2 years, we have seen problem loans ticking up, but still, those totals are still less than 1% of capital and surplus. So nothing large in terms of impairments that we've seen yet. Underlying characteristics are extremely important in the commercial mortgage loan space. I'm talking about property type as well as geography locations, right? Property type insurers have been pulling away from office properties. Obviously, with the pandemic, work from home environment, there's been a lot of uncertainty around offices. I think insurers have been a little ahead of the curve in that regard and have been pulling away from offices for a number of years. In contrast, we've seen that insurers have been looking more at industrial-type properties as well as apartment and multifamily-type housing. However, over the last year, we have been hearing mixed signals from our rated companies within the multifamily space that there could be some underlying issues that may be potentially bubbling up. There's been more construction, which could lead to some oversupply. But at the same time, we've been hearing from companies that volume is down and companies are a little bit more hesitant to get into the multifamily space on top of where they're already at. Back to the industrial property type, We've seen some manufacturing coming back to the U.S., so that's kind of a headwind there, or I should say tailwind, for the industrial property types. Best-in-class properties are very important. Properties that can easily be converted or outfitted if the property needs to change type, say from office to apartment housing, that's kind of been at the forefront of a lot of minds, that type of transition. But at the same time, technology is also looked at favorably. Those best-in-class properties that are fit with the most recent technology may be a little bit easier to transition to other forms of properties, or just offer more liquidity, right? If you have a best-in-class property with up-to-date technology, chances are you could sell that property a little bit easier, a little bit quicker than other properties that don't have those sorts of upgrades. But in any regard, due diligence is absolutely critical at insurers to look at the underlying property types and do their research. Historically, there have been favorable loan-to-values, especially compared to banks. Insurers, like I said, are more stricter in terms of underwriting. But we have seen loan-to-values worsen a little bit over the last 2 years with the fluctuation in the economy. And similar, debt service coverage is also important. Interest rates, as well as the uncertainty and volatility in the economy, has also made debt service coverage a little bit worse over the last 2 years or so than, say, historically. But so far, we've not seen anything that has risen where it raises significant concerns.
Thanks, Jason. Expanding on that, Mark, is real estate getting much interest these days as an asset class? And would you see that as a risk or opportunity?
Thanks, John. Expanding on what Jason said, I think real estate is such an interesting and fascinating sector because there's so many parts of it. When you look at all the different sub-segments and geographies and vintages, and of course, location, location, location. It really varies from one property to another, whether it's an opportunity or a risk. And so as we're looking at it, kind of breaking it out into different segments. And on the risk side, you clearly have issues with properties that are either over-leveraged or a combination of over-leverage, and with cap rates going up, the valuations going down, especially if the underlying fundamentals of rent aren't offsetting that sufficiently. So you've got capital structures that are upside down in some cases. So that's a risk. I think there's areas where there's good growth, just economic growth and demand for different kinds of real estate, especially new product. Everybody likes the shiny new thing. And generally, people are willing to pay up for the shiny new thing. So there are some real development opportunities. And then I think there's also just some stressed opportunities, as I mentioned, in the risk side. You know, one person's pain can be another person's opportunity. And I think there'll be a lot of opportunities to help fix capital structures in properties that are sufficiently good. And that will create opportunity for the people who have the capital to put it in at that time.
Yeah, and just to round out the discussion from our perspective, or from my perspective, I should say, we are staying away from commercial mortgage loans for the most part. We do not see the spreads justify the risk, whether it's office or multifamily or industrial. And what we are focused on really within the real estate space is residential mortgage loans. That's where we are seeing the value. There is a sort of secular shortage of supply there, and demand is growing. So we are seeing a lot of value there, and that's where we are focused within the real estate space.
I was going to add some of the things that we're doing that in line with what Lena was saying is we've kind of taken a barbelled approach where we do have a fair amount of like AAA CMBS and debt that we feel is extremely well covered. And even if there are some tough times in the market ahead for real estate, certain kinds of real estate properties, these will come out of it fine. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we're investing in private equity funds that are doing development, and they're still finding pockets of opportunity for growth. And then in the middle there, this sort of the mezz loans, That's an area where there's definitely a lot of risk. You need to do your diligence on which properties are okay to own mezz debt on and which aren't. But the pricing is very attractive because everyone's pricing for bad outcomes. And therefore, there are some opportunities, I think, in that space as well.
Thanks, Mark. We'll take a short break here. And when we come back, we'll take a look at structured assets. You're watching AM Best TV.
Struggling with today's challenging investment environment? New England Asset Management tailors their services to the insurance industry's unique needs. Learn more by visiting neamgroup.com. That's N-E-A-M group.com.
We're back, and we're speaking to Jason Hopper from AM Best, Lena Punjabi from F&G, and Mark Silverstein from Sompo. And Mark, what are your thoughts or concerns when it comes to corporate credit?
Yeah, I think with corporate credit right now, especially in the public markets, spreads are reasonably tight and priced for a relatively healthy economic environment, or at least a soft landing. And as Lena said earlier, I think a lot of the opportunity is actually in the private markets where you can get extra credit spread relative to the risk that you're taking. One of the things that I think is pretty positive about corporate credit right now is many CFOs were pretty smart to refinance when rates were very low and they pushed out their maturities. And even this year, as rates were low with the very beginning of the year and have ticked up a little bit, but, you know, reasonable levels to borrow money at, more companies are prepaying debt and refinancing into longer debt. So there's not really a maturity wall problem out there, except for companies that have specific, I'd say, idiosyncratic issues with their own companies. And that's always going to happen from time to time. But I think the macro environment is reasonably good right now. The primary risk is just the sort of endless economic conditions and geopolitics and technology, its impact on the way companies do business. Through that, there's going to be winners and losers. And I think that's where diligence on individual credits becomes critical to get an understanding as to whether companies are out in front of those changes or they're likely to be run over by those changes.
Jason, would structured assets be part of the equation?
Yeah, it would. I would say that life insurers specifically also have the exposure, as we already noted, on the direct lending side through commercial mortgages. So I think they use structured securities as some additional exposure, but also somewhat to balance out liquidity, right? Structured securities are more liquid than the direct lending. CMBS for life insurers is down about 4% in 2023. RMBS is up about 6%. And other asset-backed securities, such as CLOs, would be lumped into that, is up about 9%. CLOs has obviously been in the news quite a bit. That's an asset class that insurers have been increasing their allocations to. As I mentioned before, structured securities offer better liquidity than direct lending, shorter durations, so it's a way to balance out overall ALM. Speaking specifically to CLOs, insurers do typically invest in the higher tranches, and yet we have not yet seen underlying issues bubble up within that asset class as a whole yet. Structured securities as a whole, issuance is down in 2023, so I think impact, which did impact opportunity to some extent, right? So growth could also be tempered heading into 2024. But ultimately, structured securities do offer diversification within the underlying pool of collateral. And one other, I guess, somewhat newer development that we've been hearing is infrastructure-type structured securities are becoming more attractive to the segment as a whole.
Lena, is there more volatility in the markets today than there was once was? And if so, what are the impacts on portfolios?
I do think we are in a very different regime now versus the decade plus period post the GFC. Inflation is higher. rates are much higher, and while they're both likely to go down from here, they're unlikely to go down to the levels we saw post the GFC. What this really means is the era of ultra-cheap, easy money is over. I think central bank policy across the globe will likely diverge from here. I also think the trade-off between inflation and growth will be hard to navigate for central banks. And I think the result of all of this is going to bring more volatility, more dispersion, and more unknowns. So given this backdrop, we are really doing three things in the portfolio. One, we are maintaining a very defensive credit risk posture. Like we already spoke about, you're not getting paid for the risk in this environment. And so when there are bouts of volatility later on in the year or next year, I think that will create better entry points to add credit risk. Instead, we are hyper-focused on underwriting risk where we are getting paid, as well as on liquidity. Right, a lot of most of the insurance industry, specifically the life and annuities sector, their investment portfolio is underwater, right? They are in unrealized loss positions. And so you cannot really, you're constrained in terms of how much you can sell to meet your liquidity needs. You don't want to be a forced seller in the market. And so you have to make sure you always have enough liquidity at hand so you don't get into that situation. And the third thing we are doing is we are diversifying by asset class as well as sub-asset class, risk factors, sectors, issuers. You know, we talked about structured assets. They provide substantial diversification across the board, specifically against corporate credit or commercial mortgage loans. So we really like that type of asset class.
Thanks, Lena. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll consider alternative assets. You're watching AM Best TV.
Struggling with today's challenging investment environment? New England Asset Management tailors their services to the insurance industry's unique needs. Learn more by visiting neamgroup.com. That's N-E-A-M group.com.
We're back, and we're talking to Lena Punjabi from F&G, Mark Silverstein from Sompo, and Jason Hopper from AM Best. And Jason, how are insurers looking at alternative asset classes these days?
So, I mean, this is another asset class that's been continuously growing over the last number of years, specifically within the life annuity space. Private equity investments, as was mentioned earlier, is a growing asset class. Overall, alternatives are up about 6% in 2023 based on our preliminary data. Hedge funds has fallen out of favor or is continued to fall out of favor, similar to the last number of years. But overall, alternative assets are not typically correlated to the broader market, which is helpful in times of uncertainty, which we've been going through since 2020 or so. So that was a benefit overall to overall investment portfolio yield, right? But as Lena mentioned before, liquidity is very important. Alternatives, on the other hand, tend to be less liquid than your typical corporates, structured securities and things like that, which again falls back to critical asset liability management, right? Typically, the alternative space typically does not fully back liabilities. It could sometimes be more of a capital play or a spread play. That is an important factor that AM Best looks at. And due diligence also, again, remains critical. I know Mark mentioned that before as well. So I will echo that sentiment as well. Private credit, which was also mentioned earlier, has been a favored asset class. And I guess the more typical private placement 144A that you would generally think of has also been growing over a number of years, continued in 2023, up about 6% on the life annuity side. But private credit also kind of leads to third-party asset managers, right? They tend to be the originators of this sort of asset class. larger national insurers likely already had access to private credit and that asset class and these asset managers. Smaller companies, medium-sized companies may be getting a little bit more into this asset class now on more modest amounts within their risk tolerance levels. But one thing that AM Best does look at in terms of private equity or asset manager-owned insurers, the breakdown of affiliated private credit versus unaffiliated, right? If you're getting all of your private credit from your ultimate parent that is originating this, we do prefer to see diversification with unaffiliated investments as well. And one other benefit I would note is the possible restructuring terms of agreement. That is obviously easier on the private side than with public bonds. It could extend the life of certain funds. And we've also been seeing the rolling over maturing fund assets into new funds.
Mark, Jason mentioned that hedge funds have fallen out of favor. Should that come as a surprise?
I'm not really surprised, in part because hedge funds haven't produced the kinds of returns that people had become accustomed to getting before the financial crisis. And especially now with rates higher, you can earn a pretty good return out of private credit and even high yield credit. So it kind of feels like in the markets that more of the economic return of a company is going to the creditors. And by investing in high yield kinds of investments, especially for an insurance company, you can generate more of your economic return through income instead of through gains. And it's more predictable, which is always nice for a company whose earnings are continuously monitored.
So Mark, how do you manage liquidity?
Yes, as mentioned earlier by Lena and Jason, it's critical, especially as a property and casualty insurer, that we manage our liquidity to ensure that we are never in a liquidity pinch. Fortunately, it's a lot easier for an insurance company than a bank to do that. We really don't have a fear of a run on the bank. Our biggest concern is a scenario where we suddenly have claims much higher than would have been expected in normal times. So in our case, as I said, as a property and casualty insurer, we could have various catastrophic kind of events happen out there. And if we have exposure to them, then we're going to have larger claims in the short run than we may have been anticipated. And so we really think about liquidity through a series of different kinds of scenario analysis. We're always trying to estimate how bad things could be in terms of different types of events and where the liquidity needs would be in terms of which entities that we have and how long they would take that we would need capital versus or cash flow versus how fast we could get that cash flow. So we really think about liquidity, and obviously it starts with the liabilities. What's the nature of our liabilities? And then from that, we derive minimum levels of liquidity that we need to have in terms of highly liquid assets. And then we also, on the flip side, we want to have a lot of the best opportunities are in the less liquid things. So we have a limited capacity for how much liquid securities we or investments that we can have. So we think about it in terms of a minimum amount of highly liquid assets that we need to have and a maximum amount of very illiquid assets that we can have. And we essentially segment our portfolio into everything from the highly liquid to the completely illiquid. We have about four different classifications of types of investments, and we set maximums for different types on each balance sheet. So that essentially creates an illiquidity budget, or how much of the portfolio can we put in the least liquid securities or investments? And then we need to make sure that we're using that capacity as effectively as we can, since it's limited. So what we tend to do is invest in alternatives in places where we feel that there's just no other way to get access to that kind of economic return. Probably the best example would be if, for example, hedge funds or even sort of buyout private equity you know, over the long run, certainly there's a lot of private equity firms that have added a lot of value. But if you look at the industry as a whole, it does over the long run have a beta high correlation to how the equity markets do. But if we invest in the equity markets, just the public equity markets, we can get liquidity anytime we want, whereas in private equity, we can't. On the other hand, if we want to invest in real estate development, the only way to do that really is through private investments. It's very difficult to do that in the public markets. So we want to use that limited capacity that we have to the place where we'll get the biggest bang for the buck, and there's kind of no other way to do it. And at the flip side, the other end of the spectrum on the portfolio, we want to make sure that we always have highly liquid assets that are essentially a multiple of what we think we would need in a catastrophic environment where there's very high claims and we need to pay out claims quickly, like for a hurricane or an earthquake.
Yeah, I'll just add to that. I mean, what Mark described, sort of the process to set your illiquidity budget, we go through a similar process internally. But since we are talking about liquidity, I do want to make the point that, you know, CLOs get a bad rep, and there is some concern that the exposure for the industry is growing and has grown significantly the last few years. However, they not just provide diversification from an underlying collateral perspective, but if you think about what happened in 2022 and 2023 as rates went up, long corporate bonds were significantly underwater. So if you needed liquidity in that environment, you could not look to your investment grade corporate high quality portfolio. But CLOs were doing just fine because, you know, they are floating rate in nature. And so it's not just diversification from an underlying collateral perspective. It's also having different tools in your toolkit. If you need to access liquidity, you should have some floating rate exposure, and CLOs give you that, and you get paid for the risk you're taking on the balance sheet. So
Lena, I got to ask, how might regulatory changes impact insurance portfolios?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there is a lot happening on the regulatory front. The insurance industry has changed quite a bit post-GFC, as well as investment portfolios have changed in search for yield. So it does make sense that regulators feel they need to catch up, and we fully support that. What we are really pushing for is a thoughtful, transparent data and analysis-backed process, so there are no unintended consequences on investment portfolios as well as policyholders. Like we talked about, there is a lot of scrutiny on structured assets, but they do provide diversification. They give you access to markets and industries that you probably don't have access to through the corporate, the traditional corporate credit market, as well as CMOs. And I think it is important to be able to add that diversification to the portfolio.
Thank you, Lena. Well, this has been a great discussion, and I would like to thank all of our guests, Lena Punjabi, Mark Silverstein, and Jason Hopper, for an outstanding presentation today. We would also like to thank NAM for sponsoring today's special programming. For AM Best, I'm John Weber. Looking to get the full attention of the insurance industry? We have the platforms that will do just that. Whether it be AM Best TV, AM Best Audio, Best Review Magazine, or Best Day. Find out more by calling AM Best Advertising Sales at 908-439-2200, extension 5399, and have a great day.